Katie, a quick question. Under 1721, just for my own knowledge, so we have several areas that have EMS systems that the only thing that may provide additional health care is a clinic, and they may not be. So how does EMS transport when there's really no place to transport?
Well, in your environment, it's challenging. You would have to have a location for them to go to, or you'd have to have some termination of care and delegation to some other sort of entity.
And that's recognized then by DOH.
If you terminate care, and it's the medical program director that we would lean on in regards to terminating care, and terminating care would be the patient doesn't need any further care. So if they need to go somewhere because there's a medical need for them to be seen, if it's timely and they need to go in a timely manner, then you'll have to find a place to take them. If it's not timely and you want to say, well, you don't need to go today, but we do need to make an appointment for you to go see your doctor, then that's certainly something that Dr. Sullivan can craft a protocol for and you can do, but it's going to be dependent on his expertise, and we're going to lean on his expertise to create those parameters. So non-emergent.
But so emergent.
Emergent probably needs to go to a facility somehow.
Somehow. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a single entity transport. It can be multiple entities.
It can be multiple entities.
And the state and the entities can still bill for that, even though it's not recognized as a, a health care facility recognized by the state.
So the billing provisions, I'm going to defer you to healthcare authority. I don't want to speak on behalf of them because I don't know how it works when multiple entities are involved on the same patient for different parts of a transport.
Okay.
So if you have, fire department arrives on the scene, assesses the patient, takes a blood glucose, charges the patient for that. And then the patient, an ambulance gets called from EMS, EMS gets there, they take the patient, to meet him, say, with Island Air. And then the EMS service charges the patient for that. And then Island Air transports them to Harborview or Billingham and then charges the patient for that. I don't know how those segments of billing for that same patient, I don't know how that's operationalized because we don't oversee that.
Okay.
But theoretically, you could have multiple stages of transport in that case. But it would need to certainly be within the clinical criteria that the MPD writes. It has to be within the patient care procedures, which are broad overarching operational parts. So there may be provisions and PCPs you'll need to look at. So there's a few things.
Okay, thanks.
I know that's a broad answer, but. Okay, rulemaking I want to talk about because rule is open right now. What that means is that we can propose new language in our WAC, our Washington State Administrative Code. And in our rule, you're going to find regulations in regards to what you have to put on ambulances, who has to staff the ambulances, medical program directors, what their roles and responsibilities are, EMS services, what kinds of infrastructure that you have to have as far as training programs and plans and policies and procedures, how an ambulance has to be configured. All of that is in our regulations. We recognize the challenges in rural areas, and I'm an advocate for making sure that we craft regulation that is broad enough to allow there to be some flexibility and minimum enough that it's not an excessive burden. However, I have no rural voices coming to the table, and the frustration for us is nobody wants to hear the regulator talk in rural. They don't want us writing the rule. They need you. So your voice is much stronger than mine, so I just want to encourage you to come to the table for rulemaking. It's always nice to tell you why we can do rules, but the legislature gives us the authority to do rulemaking for EMS, and so here's the statutes for that. And I can leave these slides with one of you folks so that you can use them. But a rule is enforceable, so we would apply discipline in the case that we needed to. Sometimes if you have a provider, an EMS provider that, say, gets a DUI, and somebody complains to the Department of Health that you have an EMT or paramedic that has a DUI, we would take discipline on that person depending on our law. If you have an EMS service that doesn't have all the equipment required on their ambulance, somebody may file a complaint. A citizen says, well, they got here and they didn't have an AED. Then we would take action on that person. But they also establish practices, they establish parameters for us to follow, and rules really, it's important for us. That's primarily where we manage all of our work. We cannot craft rule that exceeds statute. So in other words, if there's not statutory authority for us to do something, we can't just make a rule to do it. A good example is letting EMS work in the ER. We have a lot of requests to let EMS cross-train and work in emergency rooms. It would be great if we could just craft something in rule to allow that to happen, but it will take a legislative change. And the only people that make legislative changes are legislators. And legislators don't want the Department of Health making the change. They want the citizens to make the change. So if you want these changes, then you will have to work through the legislative process from your own platforms. Things that can trigger rulemaking are identified here. We did have some legislation that passed last year that or triggers for us to do rulemaking. So that's part of it. But you should also know that all government agencies in Washington State are required to open rule at least every 5 years to do what we called housekeeping. You know, get rid of some of the old, in with the new, change some technical amendments. So our rule is open right now. The rulemaking process occurs in three stages. The first stage is what we call the CR 101 or Code Reviser 101 stage. There's three steps, 101, 102, and 103. Currently, we're in the 101 stage, and that's when we work with stakeholders on proposing language. So every month, we have a webinar, and we have in-person meetings. And so people who want to listen to what it is that we're proposing, the changes that we're proposing, you can find this information on our website. I can email it to you. I can leave you with this slide. I've included some links to take you there. But you'll find when those dates are, you can connect to the webinar right through our website. We've made it as easy as possible for you. You can join on conference call. And you can participate in public comment. If you can't make the meetings, there's still a mechanism. You can email us and tell us what it is that you'd like to see that's different. Once we're done with public work, consulting with citizens and stakeholders, then we move into the CR 102 process. That's when I have to sit down and write my significant analysis and talk about how much money it's going to cost us to make these changes, what's the impact for each thing we've changed, what are the good things, what are the things that aren't so good. And then it goes to the code advisor's office and it becomes law. I anticipate that this body of work will take probably until 2020, or the beginning of 2021 at the latest. On average, it takes about 4 years for us to do our rules because we have so many. As you can see, all these rules up here are open. We have so many. And we've made it halfway through, and we've been open since November of 2017. So we're halfway through stakeholdering. All right. Again, we ask our public to come to the table and to bring us evidence-based suggestions so that we can craft rule that makes sense for all of us that we have to follow. Here's our timeline. Our timeline has extended just because sometimes we'll get into rule and we'll get into controversial issues where there's lots and lots of passion about what we should or shouldn't do, and I admire that about our EMS stakeholders, one of the most passionate groups of people coming to the table. So you can go to our website and find out how to participate. This link will take you right there. Again, I'll leave these slides with you. And you can email us. HSQA is the Health Services Quality Assurance. That's the division within the department that we're in. And that email box is shared by me and all my staff. So if you email it, it'll come to us. But you're welcome to send public comment about our rules or anything that you need us for to that email box. Some of the other work I thought I would highlight really quickly that we're working on at the state level is, as you know, it's legislative session. We have rule open. Secretary Wiesman has asked the department to conduct a statewide EMS and trauma care assessment through a contracted entity. So we've chosen ASEP to do that. The American College of Emergency Physicians we did an RFP. And they have been selected to come in and do that assessment. The purpose of the assessment is to assure that we have adequate funding, that we have adequate regulatory structure. They bring together a panel of experts to come in and look at the entire system, from statutory authority to everything the department does. They talk with stakeholders as well and citizens while they're here. And that body of work will be done. It's the first time we've done a statewide EMS and trauma care system since the inception of our system. So we're real excited to see that happen. We'll have the results of the assessment in April, and that will likely end up informing us on new strategies. So I anticipate that although I shared with you some of our goals and visions, those may shift depending on what the assessment shows. So we're excited to see that. Another body of work that we're doing is I was able to get a grant for the Department of Health under an additional provision through the Rural Health Flex Grant. And that is to do an assessment for rural EMS systems, because the challenges aren't as visible as I would like them to be for policymakers. So this rural EMS assessment is a smaller level assessment with a special focus on EMS services in rural areas. What are their challenges? So that we can use that information to fund, to do some more funding when we have funding, to inform our policymakers on the challenges and start looking at some of the really significant problems we're having in rural EMS. Recently, the Emergency Cardiac and Stroke TAC revised our EMS and trauma, our EMS stroke triage tool. The stroke triage tool is a tool that EMS uses to determine if a person's having a stroke and where to take them. So that was revised. That body of work is done. So in your area, it doesn't impact as much, right, Dr. Sullivan?
Actually, with large vessel occlusion strokes, it does, because there are level one stroke centers.
So you'll fly them. Okay. Another body of work is, it's perfect timing for you to have conversations about consolidation and changing your license levels or types or agencies, because the regional planning cycle is open. And so Martina should have sent some sort of survey or some sort of correspondence to your EMS council here in regards to the regional planning cycle, because she'll want to know, do you have any changes that you need to implement in the plan? If you were able to align your change work with this, that's great, because you won't have to go to the EMS and Trauma Steering Committee at the end of your work. You can just do it as a part of the planning cycle. The planning cycle does end in June, and the new pay period, the pay cycle for the regions, is July 1st, and so you'll need to get it in long before June. So I would encourage you to start the conversation with her now. They plan on a biennium, so this will go into a new biennium. Worst case scenario, if you don't get it in ahead of time, you would just have to actually make the change in the plan, and there's a process to do that, but it'll take some more time. We did the air medical plan update. We've had some changes in EMS scope of practice. We've had a curriculum update with our DNR orders. That's what Pulse is. Let's see what else is helpful. Some of these other projects are helpful for you that we've done, and then I'll just leave this slide so you can see the links in your own time. Nationally, what we're seeing in the macro-national environment, they have some new criteria for fatigue in EMS. I know some of our medical program directors have reached out to us and said, how can I keep my paramedics from working 7 days in a row, 24-hour shifts, because we're concerned about the clinical care they can provide. And our National Association of EMS state offices came up with a evidence-based practice model for fatigue guidelines. So that's something I would consider your council look at, or even you and your agencies look at. The EMS agenda for 2050, in relation to your considering consolidation or changing your license levels, what we're seeing in the EMS agenda 2050, and this is the federal government pushing down their vision for EMS, ALS services, so paramedics, staying with hospital systems, EMTs, with fire systems or EMS systems. We're seeing that because they're trying to get paramedics into an academic environment. Right now, EMS is still considered vocation, and so they're trying to move ALS providers into an academic environment. So that's an overarching concept that we're seeing much of. And then, Dr. Sullivan, you're aware that they amended the Controlled Substance Act. That changes how EMS can store controlled substances. They're minor changes. Really, it was to include EMS versus not have any parameters around them at all. Some of the trends and challenges we're seeing in our system are listed here on this slide, so those are considerations for you and your body of work. These are things that we're seeing. These are things that we're seeing in our trauma registry data, in other data systems that we have, in epidemiological reports from some of our EPIs on our teams. In conversations with public health, these are some of the challenges we're seeing. There were some questions up in this community in regards to medical program directors, so I just included some statutory requirements for MPD and the WAC. One unique thing about medical program directors in Washington State is that the department appoints them, so they get a formal appointment from the Secretary of Health. They're certified, so they have an additional certification in addition to their medical practice license. And that certification affords them indemnity and hold harmless, which is, we're the only state in the 50 states that provides indemnity and hold harmless to our medical program directors for doing their work. Part of that is because MPDs, the stipend that they receive is very, very small. So one of the ways that we can encourage medical program directors or physicians to step up to the plate and say, I want to provide oversight to EMS, is say, okay, we'll give you $3,000 a year and indemnity and hold harmless. You're welcome.
Wow.
So it's not the general fund stipend is not a lot of money, unfortunately. The benefit of the medical program director certification also is that they can integrate themselves into the community. They can work with public health. They can contract with dispatch centers. There's other things they can do to help coordinate care at a local level. Many councils coordinate funding to support MPDs as well, and we encourage that. In regards to ambulance service license and verification, Jason, did you want to talk a little bit about some of this work that they'll need to do? Do you have anything you want to offer?
I think it all depends on which direction they're going to go. I think that it would be probably easiest once they get a couple different ideas than to go over that instead of trying to cap everything, because I think that might just confuse myself more than anything.
Okay. So you should know that there is a process to change licensure. So if you're doing mergers or consolidations with your EMS services and they're all licensed through us, there's a process to amend or change those. The process can take anywhere from 60 days to a year, depending on how many layers of review we have to go through. And that changes, as Jason said, depending on what it is that you want to do. So there is some process. So continue to include us in those conversations when you get to the licensing part. Remember that it's a certificate of need process, that a good comprehensive needs assessment will be your best tool for making changes in the regional plan, determining if there's new services needed.
Since we're a Q&A, so why don't you finish and then we can go into questions.
You can go into questions, you're fine.
So the idea right now that's being reviewed is really a taking EMS and bringing them back into, because at one time they were in the folds of fire, bringing them back into the folds of fire, really not to change any healthcare delivery component of it, at least in the initial phase, but just simply to take, you know, kind of its ownership from what is now the public hospital district and moving it into the fire system that is here on the island. So, gentlemen and I, or so forth, but it's, you know, from personnel, from, again, care standpoint, it's pretty much like-like. So with that in mind, what are the hurdles or the steps that are necessary? And it might be too, and you know, encompass, or it might be a lot that we can take it offline, but just as a cursory overview.
So for the portion that Department of Health oversees, the work that you'll want to do, well, three key things I think you should do. One is absolutely get citizen input, particularly if you're going to include or exclude communities such as the islands that are around the main islands. So if there's any inclusion or exclusion of that, and those taxable jurisdictions aren't necessarily well spoken to, or they may be configured differently, you'll want their input. And not just from a citizen advisory committee standpoint, because I know that you've been appointed to recognize your citizens, but so have your elected officials, but really have the conversation with the community. Because some communities in rural areas have said, we recognize that we live in a rural area, we recognize the cost, and we're not interested in supporting that. We want to do a subscription service with Airlift or with, you know, this or that. Or they have some different mechanism they want to use. And that's a conversation that's been had in some of our communities. or they'll come to you and say, this is what we expect for our money. So I think it's critical to include that.
And so when you say critical, that will be a requirement of DOH.
It's not a requirement for us.
Okay, it's not. So in licensure sharing, it wouldn't be something that you would have to see documentation that suggests that that process.
No, the only time that we will request documentation on is if you have a taxable jurisdiction that changes, we'll want to see the public records in regards to the changes to the jurisdiction. And how that impacts us is Department of Health is responsible for managing what we call trauma response areas. So think of them as a jurisdiction. In our regional plan, the regions got together in the 80s and said, in this region, we have 6 trauma response areas, and I'm just throwing out this arbitrary number. And so trauma response area 1 includes fire department 4, 5, and 6. And those taxable jurisdictions may be included in that, but if you, 4, 5, and 6, decide that you're going to merge with 7, 8, and 9 in trauma response area number 2, you're going to change the trauma response area in the plan, and so we're going to need to know how those taxable jurisdictions are now mapped and how that impacts our trauma response area, because our responsible to legislation is we've managed the distribution of resources to prevent inefficient duplication. That's a statutory requirement. And we've identified unserved and underserved areas so that those are noted in the plan, because we want to know who doesn't have service or who's underserved. So that's the lens we'll be looking at. So we'll ask for any changes to taxable jurisdiction, because that's going to impact your trauma response areas. So citizen input, your taxable jurisdictions, and the trauma response areas are critical components to understand. That's in your regional plan. As far as managing the mergers and all of the work that goes into that, we're not the best consultant for that. You're going to have a lot of different layers. You'll have labor, you'll have fire chiefs, you'll have elected officials from several different bodies.
Right.
It sounds like you've already began that conversation with most of these entities. Just recognize the Department of Health, EMS, and Trauma Care System is a system. And so distribution of resources and regional planning is body of work that you'll have to work with us on in changing your licensing. And if some of your services suddenly stop providing service to a community, that may be of concern to us. Because we're the ones that have to go back to the community and say, well, your elected officials decided this. And that's where I encourage you to have that citizen input.
Okay. From the actual license handoff from an entity, is it a license handoff, or is it an actual turning a license in and a new license?
They're not transferable, so you can't transfer it.
Okay.
There's change of ownership types, and there's just initial getting a new license. It would depend on some of the different particulars that are involved in it, which way it could go.
And you're the best one to talk to.
Yes.
On that, Jason. Perfect.
It might be a good idea to get a list of, on the application for licensure, agencies have to identify what trauma response area in the plan they fall within, if there is one prescribed. Sometimes it's the taxable jurisdiction boundaries that are listed for the trauma response areas. And they will also list what entities they're contracted with to provide service. So I know the town is contracted with the county, so that may be reflected in their application. And the areas that they serve. Knowing that information ahead of time, you can sort of craft an idea on, this is our current state, so where can we merge and go then? Then you'll work with Jason to determine how we can amend your applications. Is it throw them all baby out with the bathwater and everybody applies for new licenses, or is it amending licenses accordingly? It'll just depend on how much work you're doing and what you're doing.
And the provider numbers are associated, of course, with the license. So
when you say provider numbers, you're talking about certified personnel?
I'm talking about Medicare and Medicaid,
yes.
The personnel and all of that are tied to the license, so
yes.
That could all be either new numbers if you don't keep the same licensure.
Yes,
yeah.
That's an additional process to
yeah.
consider.
Yeah.
So do we have other CAG members that have questions or want to say anything specific?
Not on this topic yet.
The question I would have, is it the same process if, say, the hospital district wants to contract with the fire service to provide EMS service. So hospital continues to, district collects the tax dollars and all these, and they negotiate it interlocal with the fire department to say, you provide EMS now on our behalf and we'll pay you for that.
The fire district would have to get a license as well. Because they, so cause the hospital district could not give them, the fire district, their license.
Okay.
Because it's not transferable, so they couldn't share it. So the fire district would have to get a license as well, and then they could contract that way. Or the cleaner way would be to get it to where it's just the fire district has a license and the hospital district doesn't have a license anymore.
Do so they have to have, would the hospital district have to have a license to collect the tax?
That I would not have any clue about.
I think it would depend on how your laws locally are configured.
Okay.
For us, there wouldn't be an impact to us. One of the things to consider is if you maintain your taxable jurisdiction and maintain the revenue that you collect for EMS, and you decide to contract that service to someone else, years down the line, if you decide you want to do that body of work again, it's the argument sometimes will be, I want to start providing that service again, and the fire services or whoever it is that's doing that service doesn't want to give up that response area because they don't have, they have revenue invested and they've got infrastructure invested. The department can't make them go back to the other way of doing it outside of discipline. So unless they're not compliant with something in the law, we can't say, you have to give the hospital district back their taxable jurisdiction. So that provision needs to be addressed in contract. So if you're going to contract with another entity, make sure you understand that the department has no teeth outside of discipline to make somebody go backwards to a different model.
And when you say contract, to what level of contract? In other words, if it's just management changeover, is that different than, say, if personnel actually change, you know, ownership of personnel?
The license triggers for us are who are the personnel. If they were to have an injury and they report to L&I,
who owns them?
Yes.
Got it.
Whose vehicles are registered?
Okay.
Where it gets clunky for us is if you have personnel with one agency and vehicles with another, that's clunky.
Okay.
But for us, it's UBI, and the vehicles and the personnel ideally would be with the same UBI.
Which is also, when you look at the provider numbers, is the same way. I mean, you have to state who owns the people, who the people are, who the licensure is, who the vehicle is, mm-hmm. and so forth. In fact, it's one of the issues when I was talking to you about the boat. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. So, okay.
Dan, do you have any questions?
Not at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of appreciate one of the things that's really important to us as we've done our work and we're thinking of, you know, we're really trying to think into the future a little bit, is, you know, certainly the sustainability of service, both from our volunteer base, the population of the island is getting older, not younger, and that's a problem as a provider, but it's also a problem as being the service, you know, and so that sustainability piece, looking forward, is a real issue in this discussion, and you know, funding is another issue, especially on the reimbursement side of the world. And I know that you know, you stated that very clearly, that it's not an isolated problem. It's a statewide and even a national problem. And that's certainly something, regardless of this process, that's a discussion we'd love to continue to be part of and continue to try to find ways that we can find appropriate funding sources that keep these core services sustainable. That's really important. So.
Do you know in the region how San Juan County is identified in its trauma plan from a standpoint? Is it a single entity region environment that you're talking about?
We can look it up for you.
You're talking about the
Can
max?
Use my computer if you want, yeah.
Yeah.
If Remember, I took a picture.
he took a picture.
You know, and then the other issue that you brought up, which I think is really important to us, is this issue of metrics. We've talked about trying to establish a framework where we're able to measure outcomes and quality outcomes, not just service response, but when we start to talk about medical issues, how do we start to find some universal way to establish some baseline measurements about the level of service that we're able to provide today, and then how do we know, you know, how do we know we're achieving it, and then how do we start to build on ways to improve it? And I know people capture data differently, so it's been really difficult to find apples-to-apples comparisons for us to try to establish some baseline of measuring outcomes. Because if we're gonna move forward and merge services or find some other way to provide those services, how do we know we're doing a good job?
Right.
I mean, none of us want to do anything that makes us go backwards, or we don't want to hurt services in any way. So that measurement part is really, really important to us. I'm sure it's important to you, too.
Yeah, well, I think you should consider measurement in the context of different buckets, one being performance measurement. And performance is, you know, how quickly are you getting to your citizens? You know, how many times have you not had people in order to respond to a call, or had to cancel a call, or... You know, it's performance-based. It's your contract obligations. The other bucket is clinical. And the clinical-based, you could start with the statewide key performance indicators we developed for EMS. And the statewide KPIs, Dr. Sullivan can send them to you or I can send them to you, but it lists the activities that we think EMS should be measured on. Now, in the EMS industry, you should know the most important things that we do, cardiac arrest. You know, managing patients in cardiac arrest, out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, good CPR, AED use, you know, recognizing stroke, taking him to appropriate facility, and trauma care. And now we have opioid use. That's important, too. But if you look at the really big, impactful things EMS does, it's, you know, advanced airways, your respiratory arrest, your cardiac, your stroke, your heart attacks, those things. So most of our key performance indicators are in those buckets. And it says, you know, well, your EMS system responded to 20 strokes this year, and of those 20 strokes, 15 were recognized as strokes, 10 went to the most appropriate facility, and 5 patients survived with, you know, very minimal deficit. Those key performance indicators are already developed. And I spoke earlier about WMSIS, which is our Washington State EMS Information System. That's our state data registry. You want to make sure that all of your EMS services are reporting to that registry and working with us on building the quality of data that's in there.
Do you know
and
how,
that should be an objective.
Do you know how this area is reporting?
Yes, and on our GIS map, you can see the agencies that are and agencies that aren't. And so before we leave today, we can show you where to get there and how to see that.
That's okay. The voluntary data significant piece you were talking about. You mentioned in one of the bills before the legislature, I think it was the opioid bill,
yes,
that data reporting requirements,
yes,
but only for opioid cases, for all cases.
Well,
would that include the whole
registry? It would include everything, but okay. the way the bill is written, we shall have a database, and it shall include the opioid provisions. So,
so it doesn't say, but and so you should enter all of the.
Yeah. Well, they understood we had the system already. Yeah. We worked with the legislature to craft that language, so they understood that we had it already, and that. But they want to look at specific information related to opioids.
Right,
so we said, okay, we can add that.
That's why I was asking if you have a requirement in any of the legislature pending.
No. Well, that one's pending. Yes. But other than that, there is no data requirement for EMS.
Right. I'm wondering if and when that will change.
I'm hoping this year.
It might just happen in this.
I'm crossing my fingers. It didn't pass last session, but that bill is huge. So,
they could chop it up.
Yes. Yeah.
I realize.
And it's really to get out real-time data on opioid.
That's their interest. That's what
that's what they're interested in. Yes. But if it can access additional data, it'd be wonderful.
If you had a requirement for all data in there, it would certainly help.
And we have
consultants
that will come out and talk with you about WMSIS. We can send out the WMSIS data team to talk with you about that.
Be prepared.
You're looking forward to that, all right?
There is a lot.
The other thing to consider about quality assurance is that Dr. Sullivan is a big part of QA. You have to include him in the QA because he is our medical director. We appoint him.
Yep.
He is the extension of DOH for QA. And we do have a QA forum through the regional councils. The regional council does have a QA committee that's responsible for looking at trauma registry and WMSIS data, the continuity of care. So you already have a forum to evaluate that.
And we've already asked Dr. Sullivan to contribute his ideas and indicators and quality assurance and so forth, so that the document can house those metrics, so that, as Chuck suggests, we know we haven't gone backwards in our suggestion.
And is that data broken down to rural, urban, or rural, suburban, urban, or is it just
just one.
It's one
phase.
Bucket. Yeah. Yeah, one bucket. But there is, there are some key performance indicators through the National EMS Rural Health Organization, NORASH, I think. And they have some measures for rural areas. You could certainly look at those and implement those. I think there'd be some merit to that. But our state hasn't gotten to the point where we've identified that bucket specific for rural yet.
If there's,
I do ask.
Yeah, please go ahead.
You mentioned a distinction between taxable jurisdictions and response areas. Mm-hmm. And it occurs to me that one of the issues we deal with is what you alluded to with outer islands that are not necessarily in the same taxing district that fire has as they are currently in EMS. Mm-hmm. But it also occurs to me from the way you described that, that the trauma response area, for example, could extend beyond the borders of the taxable jurisdiction.
Yes.
To include those.
Yes.
In the licensing.
Yes.
So they could be licensed to provide that service. Yes. Without necessarily including them in the taxable.
Right.
Jurisdiction, which would solve one of the questions we were dealing with, which was, you know, you have different boundaries to deal with on.
Yes.
Both of those.
So the trauma response areas are prescribed by the Department of Health, and they can follow jurisdictions or include multiple. The keys for you to remember, I think, one is that if your taxable jurisdiction is providing to a service that doesn't pay into that tax,
mm-hmm.
sometimes that annoys the citizens. They're
mm-hmm.
like, why am I paying taxes for them to go all the way out here?
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's why I encourage you to talk with your citizens.
Right.
The other thing is auditors. The state auditor office, make sure that you're keeping in communication with them because you don't want to be spending tax money.
Right.
Doing something outside your jurisdiction. But be transparent and have those communications with the appropriate entities. Those are the two issues that we typically see with that. But your trauma response area, you can tell the region, this is how we'd like to prescribe and coordinate our area. And we're open to that. We want the local area to tell us, what do you think you need? And then we memorialize that in the plan.
The obvious issue is the fire district doesn't want to necessarily annex islands that
right.
they don't want to provide fire service to, but they expect EMS service out there. And they would need to have them in the trauma response area then as a result in order to say, yes, we provide the service there,
yeah.
and yet we don't provide fire.
Or they provide limited fire.
Or limited fire. Mm-hmm. I mean, the response would be different, clearly, depending, both on wildland, structure fire, EMS.
Sure.
Very different issues.
Yes.
Right? And so we need to decide how to draw those boundaries to make that all work.
Yeah, and it's complicated. The number of residents on each of those islands can vary wildly from three people to, dozens of people and communities. So.
Right. I think a communication plan, understanding how it is that they can fund the system outside of a taxable jurisdiction. I mean, is there a subscription service? You can innovate, be thinking innovative solutions.
Yeah.
Those aren't things we regulate, but we've seen this conversation in other areas of the state, so hopefully sharing that knowledge helps you.
Yeah.
Sure,
glad we have a whole month yet to go.
You can do it in a month. I believe you. I also
think
believe you can do it. If I could do a bill analysis in just a few minutes on a 50-page bill, you could do this, Ruth.